everyone. Thanks for being here. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik. Don't miss our most recent live TV show, episode 12 of Weekend Warrior. Good stuff available right now to stream or download on our members' website, redicemembers.com. We have excerpts available on redice.tv as well. Go to the TV section. And by the way, please subscribe to our YouTube channel. Don't miss anything. Catch it as soon as it's out. It's youtube.com/redice radio. It also looks like we'll be live streaming the Erken Brandt event that takes place in the Netherlands or Holland here later next week. We're arranging everything right now. It's Tuesday, the 27th. We're going to have speaking Millennial Woes, Roger Devlin, and another third speaker, which we don't know the name of yet. We'll be streaming the talks as audio only for Roger Devlin and the third speaker, but we'll have the video streaming of Woes when he speaks. We'll have more info for you as it comes in on redice.tv/live. Well, today we have a show about philosophy, art, and culture. We are going to speak with the guys from the radio show Kulturkampf, and we're going to peer into the metapolitical and diagnose the problems and discuss the remedies to it. Good show ahead. Stay tuned. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have four guests and one co-host with us today. This will be a lot of fun. It's always good to do shows, group shows, with a bunch of people. We do usually we do just kind of one-on-one, but it's really good to get a good group of guys together. So in no particular order, we have with us Gaius Tacitus, Aristocles Theroux, and Titus Flavius. All of these are from Kulturkampf, and we also have Reinhardt sitting in with me as a co-host today. Thanks for everyone for being here. It's good to have you guys with us.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Let's just kind of jump in here and do some quick introductions first so our audience can hear, obviously, who is who here first. So I guess we'll do the same order. Gaius Tacitus, tell us a bit about yourself.
Hi, so Tacitus is the pseudonym I go by. I actually have a background in computer science, and I found my way to literature and philosophy, ironically enough, in graduate school for computer science. And I started off making my own YouTube channel, which has been sorely neglected. And Titus actually reached out to me about 6 months ago and asked me if I wanted to join Kulturkampf as a segment contributor. And I had such a good time doing that, and the other guys liked me enough that I joined as a co-host.
Excellent. Very good. Aristocles?
Yeah, we joined. To start with, Titus reached out on the forums, and specifically he was asking, it started out as a kind of thing. He wanted to create a ebook depository for, you know, the alt-right, for TRS, etc. And then eventually that thread eventually evolved into him asking if we would be interested, or someone would be interested, in doing a podcast on philosophy and high culture and literature, etc. And I volunteered, which I'm usually not willing to do because I'm a bit shy, but I'm really glad I did. And yeah, I'm a student, quite young, the youngest of the bunch, and living in Germany. And yeah, so far it's been a great experience, and I'm glad I started it.
Very good. Maybe we can talk a bit more about Germany, your experiences there later, too, if we get a chance for that. Theroux? Or Theroux? I don't know how you say that.
it's Theroux. It's actually a shortened version of Theroux Cyrée Larbé, which is an anagram for Eric Arthur Blair, who you're familiar with, is actually the real name of George Orwell. So, but I just go by Theroux, usually. Again, it's kind of similar to Aristocles. Titus reached out to me, I think actually via PM on the forums, asking if I'd be interested in contributing to or doing a philosophy podcast with him. And I jumped at the opportunity, the invitation. My background's in philosophy specifically. I'm currently finishing up my last semester in philosophy, and so that's how I got into this. So it's been quite a wild ride, a lot of fun. It's a good group of guys, and I look forward and enjoy doing all the episodes that we've done and will do.
Titus of the Flavian dynasty, seems like you're the guy who pulled all this together then.
Yes, sir. Name's Titus Flavius. My background is in literature, actually, and it's one of the reasons why I wanted to start up a podcast based on sort of high culture and philosophy in particular, is that it's something that I wanted to experience and learn myself. And I know that I just sort of wanted to, sort of spread the gospel of European culture to everyone, including myself. So
we've kind of already, talked a bit about, some of the purpose of the show or some of the goals that you guys had with it. Tell us a bit more about this, if there's anything else the audience should know in terms of maybe some of the things that you guys, discuss in the show and kind of some of the other motives that you might have for pulling all this together.
It sort of came about, hinted at that a little bit just a second ago, but Mike Enoch and Sven really started once the first iteration of the forum started, really starting to push the idea of TRS of not just being a site that just that has the Daily Show up, right? They really wanted to create a platform for content, and sort of as shows started to start being produced, you had Fash the Nation and Fash Britannia. A lot of the shows that were being created were topical heavy, really focused on sort of the inertia of politics and whatnot. And I saw that there was an open market for things that are a little bit more eternal and a little bit more timeless, and that's rooted in sort of tradition and history and sort of something a little bit more ethereal than just sort of day-to-day politics. And that's sort of what I really, wanted this show to be, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah, sorely needed. It's a good initiative. I really appreciate that. Tell us a bit about the name then, Bismarck's Culture Struggle. What's the relevance to today, or is it just a cool name?
Well, the name is, branding is almost everything, sadly, in today's day and age. But, Kulturkampf, as you said, it's a cultural struggle, and that's something that I think is a paramount, a goal for us to achieve within the alt-right in turning, turning back sort of leftism and multiculturalism. I do think it is an inherent cultural struggle, perhaps even more so than a racial one, to be honest. So I think it's a name that fits perfectly with what we're trying to do as a show and what the alt-right is trying to do in general.
Just to add to that, I think that So this sort of comes into content that we haven't got to yet on our own show that we will be diving into. But really, if you look at sort of the success of the left, is that one of the things that they've been really successful at doing is sort of making Western history incoherent to our sort of current age, or our current year, our modern era, in that it's incoherent because we don't have a knowledge of it. So it's sort of like walking down a road that when you turn around, there's no more road, and so you don't know where you've come from, and it can be very disorienting. And I think at least part of that idea is built into why I jumped at this opportunity, because so much of our history is philosophy, and so I thought it would be a good opportunity to, in this cultural struggle, to give listeners and individuals interested in what, learning where we came from and how we came to think the way we do, and these institutions and systems that we have that are currently being eroded and actively attacked, came to be. And all of that is at some level rooted in Western philosophy. So I think that I like Titus, I think the name Kulturkampf is perfect.
All right, very good. Reinhardt, do you want to go next?
Yeah, so you guys decided to start off with Plato's Republic. Why did you choose to begin with this book in particular?
Oh, we can all have our different reasons why we thought it was a good idea. But something I mentioned very early on was that Alfred North Whitehead's quote all of Western philosophy is but footnotes to Plato. That was really the primary reason. We debated a bit about should we start maybe with should we start instead with the pre-Socratics, or maybe we should do the trial of Socrates, Plato's trial of Socrates and Xenophon's, so we could cover Socrates before going directly into Plato. But we decided, just as a launching pad, I guess you could say, well, it was 10 episodes, a bit more of than a launching pad, of course, but, you know, run with the metaphor, even though it's bad. As a launching pad, we thought it would be a good idea, because it's also very well known. I mean, if you start talking about Thales or Anaxagoras or Anaximander, people will be a bit confused, and it's so. In some sense, it was a little bit marketing in the sense that we can get many listeners on the first episode by talking about Plato first instead of some pre-Socratics. But it was also interest as well. I had already read it at that point, but I wanted to read it again. And so, in general, it was just also just general interest in reading it and discussing it. So that's my perspective on why we chose it.
I also thought to sort of build on that. I agree, and I would agree with everything Aristocles said, and I think that covers it pretty well. But just to add again, regarding the pre-Socratics, Plato had a really good way of sort of synthesizing and bringing in pre-Socratic views and Pythagorean views and people like Parmenides and. So in some sense, covering the Republic, you're also covering some of not just the pre-Socratics, but other schools of thought. And it's often, I think I do remember myself saying that this is often the first place that most freshman philosophy students start off with. And so I thought it would just be natural to continue that tradition. So
absolutely, very good. Any addition to that, guys?
Tess, did you want to go?
Well, that was before my tenure on the show. All I'll say is, ironically enough, this was actually the very first book on philosophy that I had read.
Nice. Yeah, it's definitely a good place to start. So, how do you guys see Plato's Republic being relevant to our contemporary culture war? In other words, which ideas, values, or concepts in particular do you think our movement could benefit the most from understanding?
For me, book four in Plato's Republic is probably my favorite of the 10 books or chapters. And in it, he sort of lays out an incredibly convincing argument for the need of hierarchy within a society, and not only the need, but that it's that hierarchy within a society, within a people, is a naturally occurring phenomena. So I think that's something that that we should certainly look at, not only sort of in the broader outlook of our movement, but within our movement as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many good things that we have coming to us from Western historical, philosophical, you know, the culture environment, basically. We have it's such an incredible rich tradition to kind of go into, and let's face it, a lot of this has actually been neglected, and people who get, you know, educated today, or that's on a very dumbed down level, and that's something we can go into a bit more later as we kind of, you know, describe some of the problems, basically, right? Of this lies at the foundation of why you guys do what you do. It lies at the foundation of why we do what we do. We're seeing, you know, the Western tradition, the Western world is being destroyed in front of our very eyes, and we need to discuss that a bit. But before we go into some of the heavy aspects of that, give our audience an idea also of what some of the other, you know, people and philosophers that you guys put focus on. I heard a couple of shows on Aristotle, Machiavelli, Locke. Tell us a bit more about some of the other people that you guys find interesting, and if there's others or which others you want to talk more about in the future.
Oh, man. So this is always a problem in philosophy specifically, that there are so many great authors, not just from our contemporary or near contemporary era, but even from the ancients. probably one of my favorites is Cicero. We did an episode on Cicero where Jess Hans McFeels from Fascination joined us. He's also a fan of Cicero. As far as philosophers that we are focusing on, I don't have it up in front of me, but I know that we're definitely going to be focusing on Kant. And here we go. Herder, Hegel. I'm a big fan of Hegel, actually, so that's sort of me sort of entertaining my own interests. Fichte, Schelling, De Maistre, Burke, and Carlyle are some of the ones that are coming up in the near future, so for the next couple of months. And it's a tough question to really sort of get at, to be honest with you, Heiner.
You other guys, any thoughts on that?
For me, first I'll just talk about what I'm reading right now that I find really good, really interesting, and philosophical, of course, is Peter Sloterdijk. He's a contemporary German philosopher, and he's highly influenced by Nietzsche. Very interesting, pretty tough read if you're not into philosophy. So I wouldn't recommend it for beginners, but if you're well versed in 19th and 20th century philosophy and you have read most of Nietzsche's works, it's definitely approachable, and I highly recommend it. And of course, what I was just talking about, Nietzsche. Of course, Nietzsche is someone who I think everyone on our panel respects very highly, and we're looking forward to. We're probably going to do at least 4 episodes on Nietzsche in the near future, or in the coming future. Obviously, we have so much stuff to get through. And then, of course, we have to talk about the postmodern theorists, Lyotard, Deleuze, etc. It'll be maybe a bit of a pain. It's a personal pet project of mine to read a lot about them, because I actually find some of their theories interesting. I know, awful. But we have to get into those, obviously, because those are incredibly relevant to our contemporary malaise and issues we're having in the Western world. So, yeah, that's my 2 cents on it.
Well, I will say, just if I can redeem myself a little bit from that terrible response, we will be focusing quite heavily on a lot of early postmodern and postmodern, as well as the Frankfurtian quote-unquote philosophers or theorists, because that's really the genesis of a lot of our problems today. And as despicable as they are, for some of them, it's you have to, you know, it's the old adage, know your enemy or know thy enemy. And so that will be one section of modern philosophy that we'll be focusing on heavily, and really sort of deconstructing the deconstructors.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting how some of the stuff within the Frankfurt School, I think people in the alt-right might even be sympathetic towards. Obviously, the overwhelming majority is divisive and contrary to our interests, but I remember listening to Jonathan Bowden talk about the Frankfurt School, and he actually praised some of their, for example, their criticisms of the military-industrial complex. So I think I would certainly look forward to hearing you guys go through some of the thinkers from the Frankfurt School and seeing if there may be overlap.
Adorno's one of the least bad, because he was a very kind of intellectual snob. He hated jazz music. The only thing he wrote that was incredibly bad was obviously The Authoritarian Personality, and that's a huge bad, because that was literally like demonize white Christian, Western white Christian people. The book, I mean, it was basically the treatise, which is still taught in sociology courses and theory courses today. So it's, but generally everything else he wrote is mostly very good, and very interesting. So yeah, you're right. There's a lot of stuff gained.
Adorno is also the guy who came up with the F scale, by the way, the personality test to measure how how fascist you are.
Yeah, the F and the E scale. Yeah.
Very objective.
Yeah, You do see that. Actually, I wrote a somewhat of a lengthy essay on Rousseau, of all people, and how he could be somewhat of an ironic ally to the alt-right, with some of his criticisms that he lobbies at in his time was current-day Geneva and France, and he talks about the erosion of the masculine spirit and society being denigrating to the human condition. And so there are, you know, he goes a totally different way with it, but there are some interesting critiques that you can glean out of some of these people that we traditionally look at as sort of philosophical enemies or hostile to our own ways of life, that present themselves as sort of a launching pad or springboard to ideas that we can create to come to, you know, the defense of our own people and our own culture and history.
Right. And I think that's one thing that draws people to the alt-right is we certainly understand who the enemy is, so to speak, but we're capable of looking at leftist like intellectualism without being completely polemical. We're able to appraise it in a more objective manner than I think the left, especially the contemporary left, is capable of doing with our side of the spectrum today.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. This is actually, you know, to tie this back into something that we can glean out of Plato, that we, well, at least from my own personal opinion, is what's important out of Plato, is that I believe it was in book 5 or 6, I can't remember, he outlines sort of the natural progression of the life and education of the ancillary or auxiliary class before they become guardians. And, you know, so for him, a guardian would only be someone who had survived the trials of all the previous stages, including being, you know, a member in the military, obviously. And at that point, the guardian class would all be basically philosophers. And it was important for him. He marks the age at 50 years of age, that at that point is when really the philosopher was ready to sort of go out into the wilds of philosophy, so to speak, and engage with all sorts of areas of thought and not sort of fall into a lot of, you know, traps. And one of these things, and I think this is important for and relevant to the modern day, is, you know, immediately when you're a budding, bushy-eyed 18-year-old going to college and you've got a professor throw some, you know, critical theory at you or some, you know, debunked marks that you get caught up in this and you say, oh, this is, you know, this makes a lot of sense. This is, look at all of this injustice. When really you are so far from being in a position where you are able to sort of objectively look at what Marx is saying or some of these critical theorists are saying and recognize which parts seem to have some sort of legitimacy and which parts are just total, you know, BS. And I think that's an important concept, you know, that.
Yeah, definitely. And that whole process is further compounded by the fact that you're hearing essentially the same narrative within every class.
Right,
it would
right.
be one thing, you know, if one teacher was teaching Marx, but when every teacher is teaching Marx, you're not hearing any criticisms of it. You think that this is what the smart people think. I should think this as well. Yeah, recently you guys participated in a live debate with a few Marxists. Why don't you tell us a little more about that, you know, how it came about, what topics were discussed, and, of course, what the outcome was.
Well, the outcome was absolute total victory, which was...
Very nice.
But, you sort of run through the... Because you actually interacted with the main sort of victim of that debate. Just sort of, you want to run through that, that sort of getting him to come on?
Yeah, sure. So I was actually approached by... I had no idea who the hell this guy was before I was approached by a couple people who shall remain unnamed within the alt-right who were like, sorry, you've got to invite this guy on your show for a debate so you can just totally destroy him and you know, it firmly and finally seat polls superiority over lefty poll. And I was like, who the hell is this guy? So I looked at a couple of his videos, and this kid's 18. He just started university. He's like your typical, you know, to use the Marxian term, petit bourgeois, just total basic. I don't know if you guys have language. Basic bitch.
No problem. Go ahead.
Yeah, he's just your basic bitch. 18-year-old shit lib in the UK who's privileged as all hell, thinking that he's leading the revolution, making YouTube videos online, talking about like the exploited working class. And I watched a couple of these videos with Tacitus and Titus. You know, everybody had agreed pretty much, automatically that we would debate this guy. So I set it up, and he initially wanted to debate like that day, right? So, and I was like, no, like we need some time to get some stuff together. I wanted to look into some of the stuff that he was saying, and I went into this thinking that I made the mistake. I don't know why I allowed myself to make that mistake, but I went into this thinking that it would be sort of like a formal debate, kind of that he would understand or even know what formal debate looks like, sort of point, counterpoint, that sort of thing. And so we did a lot of preparation, and it was clear that they did none. And so the day comes, and he's got three of his friends, two of which weren't even Marxists, and both didn't think that Marxism was practical, and so we were debating the practicalities of, or the practical implementation of Marxism in the current year, the current era. And two of them didn't, like, immediately were like, well, we don't actually think this is practical. And I wanted to say, well, what the hell are you doing here then? But I just sort of let it go.
Right.
Mostly for, because at that point I knew this whole thing was just going to be 2 hours of lulls. And it was just essentially that debate was just your literally every stereotype that you could think of a black person rolled up into a Marxist who didn't know anything, like totally derailing every question that, like, we couldn't even set up any sort of syllogism to then get them to answer so that we could, again, get them to contradict themselves, because this guy would interject and be like, well, hold up, wait, I'm sitting here trying to figure out like the librarians and shit, and like this, and like, it was 2 hours of just total cringe and lulls. And honestly, we didn't really have to do much work. They did it all for themselves. And one guy was like a transhumanist, like, you know, jerking himself off to his own transhumanism, and another guy was a Hegelian, which actually would have been an interesting discussion, but you couldn't have a discussion because he had this 18-year-old who didn't know jack shit about either his own supposed philosophy or the world, and this black guy who just would moan and ramble on about shit that just was not even relevant.
Yeah, the black guy really, unfortunately, made the whole debate. I mean, it was good in the sense that, oh, we got a lot of praise and it got a lot of views, and that was all nice, and it was kind of like a lol cow. I mean, you know, not much substance was gleaned from that debate, I guess you could say.
The only thing that was worth it for me was dropping that tactical nuke at the end. That was it.
Yes. Yeah. And it had the intended effect. Throughout the entire 2 hours, I think it was Napoleon who said, you know, never interfere when your enemy is making a mistake, and it was just mistake after mistake after mistake. And then we just sort of close it out, you know, with sort of the setup of getting them to admit that, you know, committing, you know, mass murder is okay if it's, you know, towards the ends of communism. And then, you know, Theroux set up the, well, would you kill 6 million Jews for communism? And then it just sort of,
they all just wowed and left. Like,
yeah. Yeah, what do you even say to that? I mean, that's pretty amusing. You know, I looked online at Lefty Paul, which is obviously on 8chan, and I was looking at some of their responses to that whole debate, and they were very disappointed with the performance performance of the people on their side. In particular, I believe the black gentleman who was making a fool out of himself. Everyone was very, very ashamed that these people were representing them. So I think total victory is definitely the accurate way to describe that. So well done.
Thank you. I actually went on Lefty Poll, I think, a day or so later because there was threat after, but like they were in just total disarray. And I actually got a couple of these Marxists to actually shit on the black guy, like specifically because he was black.
Now, guys, why do you think then that the kids are attracted to this, right? Because the teachers, the whole environment right now is kind of, it's a big setup. It's almost like they've used this kind of, like this is some kind of secret that you learn when you're, you know, well, later in life, right? When you're, 17, 18, 19, maybe even earlier in some cases, that, you know, all the problems in the world are going to be solved if we just implemented this kind of, this type of Marxism or this type of communism. This is kind of how they've skewed the whole educational field. These cultural Marxist professors, they've kind of taken over this. They've found a kind of an outline that seems to work. But the main question I have for you guys is, why are kids attracted to that as opposed to something else? Is it just the old attraction to kind of the revolutionary spirit that somehow this goes against the grain, they think, so therefore it's cool? Or is it more to it than that? I mean, I'm asking this because we want to try to get closer to how do we get them over to our side instead, as opposed to what these lefties are offered. But what would you guys say to why they're attracted to it?
I think it's a little bit even simpler than that, because as it was evidenced in this debate, each one of them, even the black guy, the engine kangs, they were their own special snowflake type of Marxists, and they were self-admitted having not read anything that Marx or Lenin had ever wrote. It's just that they want to be cool, they want to be part of this club, they have these flat, superficial ideas, they have no backing for them, they have no real-life experience that would tell them one way or the other that this might work. But a lot of adults, a lot of teachers, I mean, the one guy was 18, and he was going off to college the week after, according to a since-deleted video. It must have been high school teachers or just him going on Lefty Poll is how he found this. And he didn't think too much about it. He got a lot of attention because he made YouTube videos. And one thing I'll bring up is I was going on Lefty Poll after the fact, too. And a lot of them were saying that they only liked him because they thought he was cute or something. Homosexual attraction towards him, which that sort of tells you how much they care about their own ideology when that's what influences what they watch.
If I could give a targeted answer to your specific question, not just about Jizzy or however you pronounce his name, special snowflake name if I ever heard one. But generally speaking, as someone who's gone to universities in university, I would say it's a combination of multiple factors, but the biggest factor is primarily saturation. You don't really find any alternatives to, and this is part of the reason why many of the people on our side on the alt-right are former leftists. There's actually, they're either leftists or libertarians, and I think the reason why is because they're totally saturated with the leftist, in some cases Marxist or post-Marxist, and structuralist or post-structuralist, et cetera, ways of thinking. And if they're not completely pwned by those ideologies, they can still turn over. And the reason why is because those things lose their novelty after one exits university and isn't in a sinecure where you do that as a daytime job. Something Greg Johnson's talked about is that the system's no longer co-opting these young white males. So you can have all these white males learning about, critical theory and women's feminist philosophy, etc. But none of it sticks because they don't continue. It doesn't translate into anything tangible afterwards. And so maybe they learn a lot about it and they're interested in it. But I think especially for white men, I mean, maybe obviously the indoctrination is much stronger on the persons of color side, but for white men, there's just the incentives and the rewards for believing in these things are diminishing. So even if you find them interesting, like I do, for instance, there's no actual tangible real world reward, or at least it's becoming less and less every year or every month, it seems, and especially on American university campuses. You know, you're left in a prostrated position. Maybe you can have some feminist girl who pity fucks you occasionally because you believe these things. But other than that, I mean, we don't want those kind of people in our movement anyways, people who actually think that's acceptable form of compensation. So I think the reason why is saturation, and also because, at least for me, I'm not speaking for everyone, but these ideas are actually interesting. Unless you have a complete, unless you have a protective shield going into university that kind of tells you to be suspicious of all these ideologies and theories before you enter, they are actually interesting. They seem novel. They're also easy ways of explaining the world, explaining why things are certain ways, why there's injustice in the world. And of course, whites in general are more altruistic, so they want to support whatever cause has a just or equitable outcome, and so they kind of get led down the wooden path, so to speak, the wrong path. So yeah, that's what I would say.
I don't want to counter signal you too much, Aristocles, but I think you're giving them way too much credit. I don't think a lot of them actually read the theory, as we sort of witnessed in the debate. I think the draw is certainly sort of, you know, social pressures of, you know, professors and whatnot, but I think it's sort of the same reason why a suburban kid from, you know, a bourgeois household, you know, goes into punk rock. I think it's a form of rebellion that is socially acceptable, and I think that's one of the main reasons why people sort of fall into that sort of frame of thinking.
So I'm going to give my special snowflake reason why I think, and I think that there's actually a grain of truth in all of these. Tacitus was quite cynical, and Aristocles was kind of descriptive. I think that, so if you think back before, you go back, we'll use Rome or Greece, for example, the age that everybody went and fought wars, the men at least, was about the age that you go, or a little earlier, into university. And I think that specifically for Western European men, white men, around that age, I think everybody wants to, this is sort of my lofty perspective, maybe I might be giving them too much credit too, Titus, but I think we all have this desire to sort of fight the good fight, to sort of seek out honorable opponents or honorable enemies or enemies worth our attention and fight them and sort of prove to ourselves and to others that we are worthwhile. And I think and this sort of goes to Aristocles' point about saturation, there's nothing else offered. And so this is sort of presented as the only battle, the only war that there is to fight. And I think that it is so insidious because it appeals to this sort of, I hesitate to use the word innate, but this sort of innate feeling that we all have, most of us, I think we have, when we get to that age that, you know, we need to prove ourselves, we need to test ourselves and know our limits, and we need a formidable challenge, challenging opponent to do this. And I think for many young kids, and most of these kids are white, they're upper middle class, they've never been tested really that much, especially physically, and that's a huge part of it, that they see this as sort of the only realistic or viable possibility that's being given or presented to them. You know, for my part, when I was that age, I was over in Iraq fighting a war. So, like, I was actually, you know, figuring out what I was made of. And I think that this is why it's so insidious and it explains why so many people are taken into it, is because it does sort of play on, Titus mentioned altruism. I think it's a sort of this, if it's not innate, it's been bred into us through 2,000 years of combat, that we need fights and we need challenges because that's what gets us lives. That's how we prove ourselves, and that's how we pass on our lineage. That our lineage is even worthwhile to pass on is that we survive fights and we make a name for ourselves. So that would be my sort of philosophical examination of it.
So the drive, so to speak, is correct, for the lack of a better term. It's of an honorable quality to a certain extent. They have a sense of duty, maybe even a drive to improve the world. You know, there was other situations in the past when young men, as you said, they went out into battle or they went out to sea or something like this, right? And so the lack of these things to a certain extent in our society is causing people to go into this level of kind of politics, of trying to improve things. They think that this is somehow going to make the world a better place, right?
Yeah, I think that most of these people, when they first get into it, kind of like ZZ, they genuinely actually think they're doing good, or they mean or they hope to do good, and they have sort of this noble intention. You do see with more committed leftists, anarchists, Marxists, nihilists who are in the left, who have been in the left for a long time, quite high rates of despair. They're very depressed. So you get this sort of weird sort of dynamic where all of these people going in are sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, hopped up on, you know, their own delusions of grandeur, I should say, or their desire to do good and to fight a noble fight. And then it goes on and they sort of see the writing on the wall, but they can't really admit to themselves that the fight that they chose or what they were presented was the wrong one. So this is good for us because if, you know, for those of us fighting for Western civilization or fighting to retain its memory and forge something new, I should say, you know, we can work on that. We can appeal to that. If we can present ourselves as the alt-right or whatever, if the alt-right becomes known as something else, as sort of like the noble alternative, and the, you know, the true alternative as if you were a white Western man or woman, this is the fight that you need to engage in, and the fight that will allow you to sort of continue your namesake and your legacy. And it is a worthwhile fight. This is a fight worth fighting.
So we have this aspect of the underdog weaved into this, which kind of is a concept I've never really liked, to be honest. But yet I understand the draw of it. You know, understand the pull of it.
The underdog specifically, the reason why it's become so popular, especially in, there's been studies done on this, maybe you've heard of it, but basically tracing the idea, it's kind of an intellectual history, you know, academic study of the idea of the underdog, and especially in the U.S., and basically they found that it was primarily came out of Hollywood, of course.
Yep.
Well, that's all you really need to say.
Yeah.
I think most people in our circles can kind of extrapolate from that where that came from. And of course, it's always been present to a certain extent. Of course, everyone, you know, because they see maybe due to resentment, class envy, call it what you want, they see themselves, the have-nots or whatever, the masses, they see themselves in this up-and-coming, this challenger, right? You use a historical example, Spartacus, for instance, or something like that. They see it as empowering, and that's always been a trope in probably almost all civilizations. But the accentuated and exaggerated nature to which that kind of archetype, I guess you could say, is worshipped in the West is primarily because of that. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, it's true. I mean, it's a Jewish invention altogether. You can even see, I recommend people to look at Hollywoodism, the documentary that kind of traces the origins of Hollywood, and this concept of how they're talking about a shadow America that they kind of invented and how this role, which primarily kind of put forth this idea of the underdog, was the overpowering image of what many Americans came to identify with. Really interesting documentary that details that. But back to my initial point there, whether we like it or not, or whether we, you know, we can see the true origins of it, maybe there's still something to the fact that we can maybe work with that as opposed to against that. So my point would be, if there are any underdogs, true underdogs today, it wouldn't be these Marxists who think that they're challenging the world in any kind of capacity. It would be us that are the true underdogs. This is something we can work
with. Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's, and this is, I'm not sure how familiar you are with Nietzsche, but essentially you see this, you know, everywhere Jews go. I mean, they take traditional pillars and they invert them. And Nietzsche calls this the slave revolt of morality. And for him, that was what Christianity was. For traditional European society. And so, again, like, you know, to your point about Hollywood, about the underdog, I mean, the underdog is the one who's, by all rights, should, you know, be, I hesitate to say, is inferior, but at that current point in time is the one who's losing the fight. And so people are made to sort of think that, well, the one who's losing should actually win, right? And so we see this
right.
kind of perverted mentality with people like Justin Trudeau who say, you know, if you kill your enemy, they win. Like, it's this total inversion of just logic and just common sense, and they do this everywhere they go, and it is. It's sort of a slave revolt, and we can see it in gender roles, and it's basically everywhere. Once you sort of read that part of Nietzsche and you see it, and you're like, holy shit, you start seeing it everywhere.
We can see it in the...
about this too.
Yeah, we can see it in the 2016 election. Just this last week, Hillary Clinton's pneumonia is a sign of her strength, right? She can fall and collapse on the floor, and that's why we need her as president.
Yeah, it's the nobility of the suffering of the leper. I just wanted to say real quick, just for intellectual rigor's sake, because this is something I conceded. In our Marxist debate, which I do think is true, and I'm sure some people would disagree with me on the alt-right, and that's fine. But I don't think that the left, the kind of hardcore leftists, really, we still believe in Marxism. I don't think they're the ones in power today. I think, and you can just see this by how, I mean, you could say, okay, they always want to feel like they're losers, etc. But I really do think that they feel like the world's kind of gotten away from them in a very similar fashion to what we do. And I'm talking about here very hardcore leftists like Alain Bédois, Zizek, etc. They don't think the world's in their control at all, and they're correct in a certain sense, because radical ideologies rarely can achieve kind of hegemony, right? What we have today is a very watered down, lukewarm compromise, I guess you could say, compromised leftism. And a lot of leftists, especially hardcore Marxist types, they're correct in a certain sense when they say that, you know, it's out of their control, that they don't have any control. You can make the implication genealogically that their ideas have great influence in that, but of course it's not good enough for them. And I agreed that it's true that the hardcore, the far left, you could say, or whatever, don't have very much power. Of course they have much more because they're not hunted down and they're not prosecuted like we are. But in a sense that almost gives us more power. Because the radical left today is kind of considered harmless. Some of their ideas trickle down into the academy, but nothing that will upset the social justice warrior, neoliberal drones, right? And hardcore radical ideas, whether left or right, are upsetting. They're perturbing. And, yeah, so that's just what I wanted to say, just for the sake of intellectual...
Do you mind if I jump in and add on to that?
No, go ahead.
He's got a really good point. Aristides, I think you've got a good point there and some good insight. And you know, if you guys haven't listened to it yet, it's a decent episode. It's actually a good episode. The recent Daily Show episode with Spencer, he mentions, he references Sun Tzu's remark about, you know, you always want to leave your enemy with a way out, and because if not, they're going to fight to the death because they don't have any other choice. And so I think this is one of the fatal mistakes of leftism, is that especially today we see with, you know, in Jews, you know, 80 years later, they're still prosecuting quote unquote Nazi, janitors and accountants, right? They don't leave their enemies with any way out. And so, the alt-right is sort of that manifestation of that sort of fight to the death mentality. And, I think it will be their undoing because I say this a lot, you know, when white Western men in white societies, when they get really pissed off, they're really good at fucking shit up. They're really good at it. And, our movement is typified by really, really smart people who are motivated. And we're pissed off.
The white kids angry.
Right. And, you know, and we don't have any other option. And I think that's the fatal flaw. So, I agree with Riskley's point.
Well, very good. This is very interesting. We're obviously just kind of getting started here. I think we should take a short break here, though, at the end of the first segment, and then continue kind of just going right into the meat of it here in a little bit, and continue to kind of diagnose the problem, really, and try to get closer to how we what we can do to turn this around, and what tools and weapons that we have at our disposal in the current way that this fight is playing itself out. So we have much more to get into here, but gentlemen, do give us a little bit more details about the show, of course, how people can listen to it, how often you do it, and if there's any one of you that want to give out, I don't know, if you have another website maybe or a Twitter handle or something like that you want to give out, please do that. The floor is yours, gentlemen.
So I did start a supplemental website for the podcast a couple episodes after we started doing the podcast. You can find that at www.kultulkamp, spelled just like the show name is. So kultulkamp.org. And it's been sort of neglected because my schedule's been quite busy. All of our schedules have been quite busy. And for myself, you can find me on Twitter at VoxRomani, VoxRomani. And the other guys have Twitter accounts as well. So.
Yeah. So also what we're doing upcoming, our schedule has had a bit of a spanner thrown into it, obviously, because of the debate and now the interview, which is, you know, very, very good, though. It's nice to take a break from routine and a habitual kind of schedule once in a while. And we thank you very much for this opportunity to do this interview. But our next upcoming show will be Rousseau's Discourses on Inequality, and then after that we're doing a three-part series, at least we hope, on the French Revolution, going over Burke's, de Maistre's, and Carlyle's interpretations of the French Revolution. So, yeah. And you can find me on Twitter at @Aristocles_INV. So, yeah, pass it on.
Yeah, and our show, forgiving any sort of break in the schedule, always is published at TRS Radio on Thursdays. And my Twitter handle on Twitter is Tarpeian_rock. It's TARPEIAN.
Just to finish this off here, I mentioned earlier I actually have a YouTube channel, which I have two videos that I've been sitting on for a while. I've covered the works of Dante, well, his main work, and a couple of general shows, and that's just under the pseudonym Gaius Tacitus, and my Twitter account is American Tacitus.
Well, very good, gentlemen. We'll, of course, have the links up to the websites, and we'll add some links to the Twitter handles as well, in case you want to get a hold of the guys. But yeah, very good. I think we should just take a short break, gentlemen, and then we'll return with more. So stay with us, everybody, and we'll be right back. Don't miss the second hour coming up. We've extended the next segment a bit as we get into the details of diagnosing our societal pathologies and what we can do to turn this around. It's an excellent second hour that you shouldn't miss. RedIceMembers.com is the site for subscribers who want to stream or download this continuation or any of our previous shows. We have over 1,000 shows and growing each week. If you're not yet a member, definitely check it out. Tons of shows for you in the archives. And don't miss the new edition, the live TV show that we broadcast exclusively on the members' website. We have a growing number of people tuning in each weekend. You can also chat with other members during the show. And yes, we are working on a new members' website as well, a much-needed update. We'll probably bring in a bulletin board and make things a bit more interactive. We promise to make this part better. We're also going to do a few live shows where we take your calls as well and hear about your concerns and ideas. So stay tuned for that. We also, by the way, still have Red Ice t-shirts available, 100% organic, really comfy t-shirts that also is a way to support us. You can go to redice.tv/store. All right, folks, upcoming on the program before we proceed here, we have two Dutch guys, Bart and Michael, who are putting together the Erkenbrand conference in about a week from now in Rotterdam in Holland. We'll have more information about the live streaming on this soon here as well. We also have Paul Kersey coming on the show. He's the author of Whitey on the Moon and creator of the website Stuff Black People Don't Like. We also have Daniel Hammarberg and many more coming on after this. All right, well, we'll talk to you after the break. Thank you for listening. We'll be right back with more. Stay tuned.